Good morning!
Morning!
Good morning!
Oh, and in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
This is my boomstick!
Here's Johnny!
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Righteous! Righteous! Yeah!
I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Good morning, Vietnam!
Houston, we have a problem.
The first rule of Fight Club is... you do not talk about Fight Club.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. This is Those Film Nerds Podcast. My name is Will Spalding, and as always, I'm joined by the ever-talented Sam Deerberger. Sam, what's up?
Ever-talented. How we doing?
You know, Sam, that right there is the 50th time we have done it. This is episode...
No way!
This is episode 50.
Wow.
And we're pretty excited. And I know we always say, like, thank you for watching, or thank you for listening. Not watching, you don't watch podcasts. But actually, we do thank you, and we appreciate it for sure. So thank you to anyone. This is
anyone who might be
listening. It's a good amount, Sam.
Anyone, yeah, 50, that is weird. That's strange. Halfway to 100.
Yeah. So this is about a year too. 50 episodes. We have done one a week, except I think we missed 2 weeks.
I think we did. Yeah. We had one, we had a lapse in like November and another one early this year.
Yeah. I think like the first one was like finals week or something. And then this last one, we were both kind of in Florida, so we've done pretty good. So this is literally 1 year. 50 episodes, we missed 2 weeks. This is 1 year, Sam.
That's pretty good. That's a pretty good schedule to stick to.
Yeah, not bad. So
it's kind of crazy. It's kind of crazy that it is 50 episodes, because it doesn't the conversations we have on here are so natural and just,
yeah,
you know, unforced, that you don't even pay attention. It doesn't even feel like work.
Right, exactly. I mean, we do get paid a lot. So
yeah,
it is work, but it doesn't feel like it. And all of the interns at TFN headquarters, they're all really excited. They're all, you know, they're still grinding away. And
Now understand, they are interns and we could pay them, but we choose not to.
No, they're unpaid. Yeah, we don't pay them.
The knowledge is just too valuable.
Right, exactly. But no, so, you know, it's slightly out of convenience, but for episode 50, we're gonna start kind of a new series on this podcast. We'll see how far we make it. I don't know. It's kind of interesting to both of us. We're gonna go back year by year and look at every Best Picture winner, all the way till 1929. We're gonna do them all. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, so we've in honor of the Oscars being just a little while ago, so we've done Nomadland, the previous Best Picture winner. So go check that episode out if you haven't already. But Sam, what are we going to be doing this week?
This week, we're going to be talking about Parasite.
Again, for anyone familiar, this is where we'd play. This is where I always say this for foreign language films. This is where we'd play the trailer, but I don't speak Korean, and I'm assuming most of our listeners don't either. So I just didn't bother. although we could hear the beautiful dulcet tones of Mr. Song Kang-ho, but I decided to skip it. So yeah, this will be exciting, man. Right. I just want to talk a slight amount of industry news before we get into this, but yeah, this will be a cool series. Sam, do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's a bit of an ambitious undertaking, considering, you know, all things considered, for the last year, really, we have done a pretty good job at finding new releases to talk about every week. So we don't do a whole lot of retrospective episodes on, meaning like movies that were released before this year. So, you know, we'll see how far we get.
Right.
Because we probably do what, like 4 or 5 retrospective episodes in the last year. Yeah.
You know, we've done Inception. We've done Casablanca. We've done Citizen Kane. That might be it.
We talked the Indiana Jones franchise.
Oh, yes. Yep. We okay. Kind
of combined a all of them.
A limited amount, though.
Limited amount. So I figure, you know, we'll see how far we can get.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll knock a few out this next year. It'll all depend on releases.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an ambitious project, and we're excited about it.
Maybe if nothing piques our interest, that'll be just what we do for that week. Is a previous best picture winner. Excuse me. So. I know Sam's, he told me right away, he's like, I just can't wait for Green Book and Shape of Water. Can we just start with those? Like, do a double feature? I said, no, let's do Parasite. And you were insistent, though, on Shape of Water. You said, you told me, you're like, let's do an hour on the sex scene alone, the fish sex scene. That'd be a little weird, but we could, I guess, so.
Everyone knows the real name of that movie is Grinding Nemo. Everyone right. knows that.
Yes, of course. Oh, gosh. All right. But before we get into Parasite, I wanted to talk a little bit about Marvel's Eternals. And Sam, I know you're not a huge Marvel movie fan, but will you see this movie with Chloe Zhao directing?
Ask me in about a year.
Okay.
Because, you know, I'm not over the whole Nomadland romance that we're currently engaging in the industry. I think she's really talented. I thought Nomadland was beautifully shot. I think it's kind of interesting that she's doing a project like this now after making a kind of like a semi-documentary
You're going from like a $500,000 budget to $250 million budget. That's a little bit different.
I really no frame of reference for what she'll do with it or how she'll perform, because it's not like we're talking about a Michael Bay here. So, yeah, you know, if the trailer looks good, probably go see it at some point.
Yeah, well, initial images just dropped yesterday, and it looks cool. I mean, you know, we're going to get a couple sunrises and a couple sunsets. It's a Zhao trademark. And
yes,
executive producer Kevin Feige, who produces all of the MCU movies, has said it will win Best Picture.
Wow.
I mean, that's a bold statement. It probably won't, but... there's only been 2 comic book movies ever to even be nominated for Best Picture. So that'd be a feat of its own. So,
Yeah.
Interesting nonetheless.
I mean, totally. Did you have any other pieces of news?
Well, I just want, the one thing I will say about this movie, the Eternals, I'm not sure if it's Eternals or Eternals, doesn't matter. A different cast for sure. It's not, there's a lot of star power in there. And going with someone who has more of a, not to sound like pretentious, but artistic background, I don't, more awardsy movie background. So it'll be interesting to see a different take on a superhero movie.
Yeah. I'm not really attached to this particular
You're not the target
franchise. I'm not demographically, I'm certainly the target audience. It's just me personally.
Right.
If Marvel knew anything about me, they'd be like, oh God, no, we don't want you watching our movie.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. They only see people as numbers anyway, as we've discussed. We'll see how it shakes out. It'll be
sure.
interesting, for sure.
I don't have anything else, Sam. I don't know if you do.
there's one thing I did want to mention.
Go for it.
Tom Hanks. I think we talked about this before. Tom Hanks's new sci-fi film, now called Finch, it was previously called Bios, is headed to Apple TV Plus. So he's going from the movie Greyhound, which was released last year on Apple TV Plus, to this new sci-fi film, which is supposed to be released in August, I believe. So, you know, Apple TV, all of a sudden, just out of nowhere in the last year, just stepped into its own in the streaming wars, you know, in terms of producing original content.
Yeah, for sure.
Because before that, they made like a couple of original TV series that no one really watched. Because they and it had some big stars attached, you know, Steve Carell and everyone. Nice. But now they're, because they have the revenue to be able to, you know, add star power, even though no one's watching. Now they're starting to gain traction, or at least they're making really big bets with movies. Because they had Greyhound, which was a pretty big budget movie. They gave Martin Scorsese $200 million to make a Western movie, which was in development, which we're all very excited for, Killers of the Flower Moon. And now we have this sci-fi movie that they just bid for to be released in August. What do you make of all this?
Honestly, what I make of it is that they're trying to get into the game, which is good, I guess. I mean, that's one more streaming service that you're going to have to decide whether or not you want to purchase, which, you know, that is what it is. That's a different conversation in general, but yeah. I see no reason why Apple shouldn't get in on this. I mean, they have so much freaking cash just sitting that why not use that cash, give someone money to go make a movie and make more money doing that. I mean, there's no reason why they shouldn't be doing this, especially if they have the platform, why not?
Yeah. It's just an interesting way to go about it. And like you said, it's because they have a lot of cash, but like with the only model you can really follow is Netflix, right? Like the only precedent is really just Netflix in terms of original content. And they stepped into their own with, you know, maybe 2018 with Roma, kind of a lower budget drama thing that really gained steam during Oscar season.
Right.
And then I think I would say the main catalyst for original content would be something like Stranger Things, which is a mid-size budget TV show that just became insanely popular.
Mm-hmm.
And then that led to more and more respect, and then you get into this last year things like Mank or The Trial of Chicago 7 made by reputable you know, directors and writers. Yeah. And everything.
Yeah, I mean, people are going to them. I mean, Scorsese, honestly, aside from like Nolan or Tarantino, would have been like the last guy I would have thought to go to a streaming service to make a movie. But if somebody's going to give me $200 million to make whatever movie I want and they're not going to like say anything about it because they trust me.
Yeah.
Heck yeah. I mean, a lot of production, Warner Brothers especially, is notorious for doing this, but getting a little picky and like getting involved, which can be a terrible thing to hear for some filmmakers. So yeah, I mean, if streaming services especially like let the directors that they hire just do their job, then it'd be perfect.
Yeah. And we'll see that as kind of a new haven for artists and
right
entertainers.
So, Sam, could you see like Nolan or Tarantino ever doing that?
I don't think so. I think Tarantino particularly hates the streaming services.
Yeah, well, Nolan's biggest screen as possible is his deal, so streaming service seems out for him.
Right. Unless we could see some kind of company kind of move into both spheres, but I mean, even then, it's it's still difficult to see.
Yeah, because some people would still watch it on Netflix on their TV. So,
yeah, I think Scorsese's position is more like a movie's a movie, you know.
Yep. Yeah.
He's just so incredibly versatile that he's made all types of film, you know, and he's made movies that are, you know, probably more specifically to be consumed in the comfort of your own home. And then he's made movies that are supposed to be watched at a theater. And I think recognizing that there's a difference in how you approach a film based on, okay, this is going to be watched at home versus this is going to be watched in a theater. I mean, recognizing that there's a difference there and both art forms are valid, I think is going to be crucial for the future.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, that's a lot of good points there. It'll definitely be interesting, you know, this stemmed from Apple TV, but it'll be interesting to see where all of the streaming services go. I mean, Netflix kind of seems like they know where they want to go, but everyone else is just kind of basing what they're doing off of what Netflix is doing, or to some degree. So, yeah. But Sam, should we get into Parasite?
Yeah, let's get into Parasite.
Cool. So, I guess let's just start with, you know, what is your first experience with Parasite? What was the hype? Do you remember, like, like why did you want to see this? When did you first hear about it? Like, what about Parasite? And then
I remember. Yeah. We'll get into the film itself, but man, I remember talking to you about this back in. I remember you watched it super early on.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah. Before it was really seriously getting the hype it was. And really out of nowhere, this Korean movie just sweeps everyone on Letterboxd.com, which at the time, and really still is, but at the time particularly, was kind of our main mode of looking at the current state of movies, you know, like what is popular on Letterboxd right now. All of a sudden, this Korean movie shoots out of nowhere and is getting average reviews, higher than The Godfather. If you're on letterboxd.com, you know that they take the average score out of 5 stars and kind of display that, so then you can have an idea of, you know, a Rotten Tomatoes score for the common people on letterboxd.com of how good a movie is. At the time, The Godfather was in the number one spot on average of all time, 4.5 stars out of 5, I think it was, which is very hard to do. I mean, it's impressive enough if your movie can average more than 4 stars there. And then Parasite sweeps in with a 4.6 out of 5.
Yeah.
And we're like, what? What is it about this movie? So yeah, I was pretty unexposed until you watched it initially. But yeah.
Yeah. So like you said, when I watched it, the hype was there and we all kind of knew about it, but it wasn't to the degree that it was like 4 months later, like when it was just winning every award.
Yeah.
And yeah, now, like you said, it's sitting at number one on Letterboxd, and we can talk about that a little bit more later. But yeah, I remember seeing this movie and coming to school the next day and telling you one word, and I said efficient. I think it's efficient storytelling for sure. I mean,
yes,
we see a lot going on in this movie. A lot happens and it's all really pretty tight, and there's not a lot of mistakes. There's not a lot of, you know, wasted time. So this is a really good movie.
Yeah. It's very much iceberg-y. It kind of has, it's so efficient because it has several layers in each scene. Rather than try to drag out all these different themes and messages into a really long movie, it's kind of condensed, and they just put the layers underneath each other. And what I found in discussing this movie with people after watching it is there were symbols and metaphors and things I didn't even pick up on the first time around. There's just so much to appreciate about the film. And yeah, it was just astonishing. It really was unlike anything I had ever seen.
Yeah, for sure.
Singularly unique movie, for sure.
That's not to say that this movie doesn't have its flaws, because I think it certainly does. But this movie is one of a kind, absolutely. I think... I guess try to remain spoiler free for a few minutes, but this is a year old movie, 2 years, so we're probably fine. But there's, for anyone who knows, there's a very distinct turning point in this movie, and it almost feels like two separate movies, but they're just linked so well together that they were able to put them together almost, it seems like.
Yeah.
And they have complete... The first and second half have completely different tones and means of telling the story, and definitely narrative. And, you know, so there's a lot. It's crazy how it's able to do both sides of this kind of happy-go-lucky first half, and then this really dark and mysterious second half. Yeah, it's crazy how Bong was able to show both sides of that.
Yeah, definitely. And to your point too, I mean, this Parasite is almost impossible to put into a genre.
I would dark comedy, maybe dark comedy / thriller.
It's too light to be a thriller in some respects. It's like a family dramedy with, thriller overtones, maybe.
Well, the three genres listed on Letterboxd, at least, is comedy, drama, thriller. So in that order. That's what's so unique about it.
It's really hard to pin down. It's really hard. I just don't know. But yeah, that was one of the first things. As soon as you start watching this thing, you're like, where is this going? First of all. And secondly, like, how am I supposed to feel?
Right. Yeah. I mean, we start the movie off with the Kai Tech family. Really poor family. Living in a poor part of Seoul, South Korea. And there's an opportunity essentially for the son of the family to get a job, as the, he is a tutor, as the tutor of this, this girl in this rich family's home. So he takes this opportunity, gets the job, right? And this is probably my favorite part of this movie, is like the next 30 minutes. You know, we've seen how they're really poor and their life kind of sucks. And then their transformation from being this poor family to almost like acting like this rich family is so awesome. You know, we see the son then help get his sister, the daughter, get a job there as... the art teacher for the rich family's son. And then they help get their mom a job, and they help get the dad a job as the driver. And that 30 minute sequence is so well done. And it's not a montage, obviously, because it's that long, but it almost feels like one. It feels like a long montage without having any like the nauseating montage effects. So
yeah.
like I said earlier, it's such efficient storytelling. I mean, you know what's happening the whole time. It's very easy to follow, but it tells a lot as well.
Yeah, and I would say, too, relating to that, right away when we meet the high techs, they're the Kim family. That's their name. Sorry.
Oh.
The father's name, Kai Tech. My bad. Yes, my bad. Because okay. we get the Korean style of surnames.
I always
say that. Yeah, I do too. I do too. Yao, not Ming. But what's so interesting about the Kim family is they are obviously very impoverished, but it's a very realistic look at modern first world poverty.
Yeah, for sure. They still have cell phones and
they're not starving, you know. No. They have shelter, they have a place to live. And it was so refreshing to see that. One, because we really don't understand, but it's hard for us to comprehend as Americans. But, you know, like South Korea is about as westernized as it gets in Europe. You know, they're basically a mini America. You know,
Japan.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I suppose so. But, you know, with South Korea, I mean, the American influence is very prevalent because we had occupied there forever. But so, I mean, that's interesting. And it kind of brings American audiences into understanding that culture and how it's really not that different from American culture. And then, yeah, I mean, that entire sequence of just where we start to understand why the movie's being called Parasite, or at least one of the applications of that title, Parasite, where we start seeing the family kind of eat its way in to this wealthy family. Yes, it's ridiculously efficient, like you said.
Yeah, so about probably the 45-minute mark, all of the family has the job. All of the Kim family have jobs inside of the Park family. Obviously, the Park family does not know that any of them are related in any sense. The little kid has some ideas, but... So we kind of move on, and the Park family is going out of town for a little while, so they're gonna stay. The Kim family is gonna stay inside the family house. And again, everything is really, you know, like I said earlier, kind of happy go lucky. They're in great spirits and. You know, they're living the high life, really, and everything's kind of looking great for them. And it's a really fun movie in the first 45 minutes. You know, you kind of have a smile on your face the whole time because these really poor people who are the protagonists are succeeding, which is really fun to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'll push back on that a little because there's. Well, you know, first we have Ki-woo, who's the son, kind of move into this kind of benign position as a tutor, you know, and he does a good job as a tutor. So it makes sense. But then we start seeing that they're replacing with the chauffeur and the housekeeper. They are replacing innocent people.
Yep.
they fake the old housekeeper having tuberculosis to get her fired. So the mom can get a job. It's really cutthroat and it's kind of awful. But we don't really think about that for the first half of the movie.
Right. Well, we don't really know those other characters. So you know, they don't really matter to us.
Right, right. But there is that sneaking suspicion in the back of your head, like, oh boy, there's going to be hell to pay for that.
Yeah.
We
can go right there now. You know, they're in the house, they're all having a good time, and the old maid or housekeeper comes to the door, and none of them are supposed to be there, obviously, except for the new housekeeper, the mom.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a confrontation, really. This is where that turning point I kind of mentioned earlier happens. It's a total shift of tone, and it's really effective. And we find out that this old housekeeper, her husband, lives in the basement, in this secret basement that the Park family didn't know about, because they bought the house and the realtor didn't tell them, essentially. And what do you think about this part? What do you think about the reveal, Sam?
It's quite a reveal, because there's a lot to unpack. One, it's very well done, because that scene, it's dark, it's stormy, it's ominous, and we get this old housekeeper at the door. And I mean, that's creepy enough on its own. And the old housekeeper comes in and is very insistent that she be able to come in and basically feed her husband, who's been living in the basement for years. Yeah, I mean, there's that. There's also the fact that that reveal kind of comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I still haven't made up my mind if that's a strength or a weakness in the film. The reveal comes out of nowhere, because it's never previously hinted at that there is a secret basement. You know, it's not even brought up. So that comes out of nowhere. But also, the basement serves well for the kind of layer metaphor of this film. Early on, we see the family gets a scholar's rock, which is meant to promise wealth. And you notice on the rock, it has multiple layers. It's sedimentary. Yep. So I know many essays actually have been written about the rock as it relates to a metaphor for this film. But So, I mean, that works well. I really like the fact that there is a secret basement. There's kind of this idea of an underclass that the wealthy aren't paying attention to, kind of mooching off of a shelter.
You know? Yeah. I really like this reveal. I think it's really effective. And you were kind of pondering, is that a strength or a weakness, that there really was no hint? I think it's probably a strength. You know, there's no hint because this basement, nobody knows about it other than the old housekeeper, which we didn't really spend much time with, and her husband who lives in it, who we don't have access to. So I think it works well. There's definitely ways you could rewrite it to make it not be a reveal, but I think it's fine. And then it's a really good reveal, or a really good couple scenes following of the Kim family struggling to keep their secret hidden. So the old housekeeper goes down and finds her husband, who's been there for days or months or whatever, with no food. And this is one of my complaints, actually. If the Kim family were smart, they wouldn't have all gone down into the basement and then fell over. That was kind of lazy writing, almost. How they get discovered by the married couple that is living in the basement. Slightly lazy, but it is what it is. So anyway, they get found out, and they're kind of held hostage because they have a picture that they're all together, and they're going to send it to the Park family, the family that owns the house. And this is where things really escalate. The Park family then calls and says that, you know, they're not going out of town anymore because something came up. It's raining a lot, and, you know, they're not going to go camping. So they're coming back. Everything's kind of a mess. How does this sequence work for you, Sam?
Yeah, I mean, talk about a shift in tone. I mean, then we have this kind of like violent struggle, you know, for the cell phone. Because one side's trying to call the family, one side's trying to send this picture as blackmail. And yeah, all of a sudden, we in about a period of like 5 minutes, we went from, oh, this family is kind of living it up. They all have jobs at this house. They were all drinking. They were having a good time. And then boom, a whole nother element of the story is introduced out of nowhere. And yeah, like you said, this is where the shift in tone happens. So it works well, you know. We get to see some action in this movie, kind of action, yeah, I guess. Where a lot of physical fighting over the phone. So that works really well for me. I think it adds to the movie's like uniqueness.
Right.
So yeah, excellent scene. And basically it's a race against time before the Parks come home early.
Yeah. And at this point, like you said, it's a race against time. They're trying to clean the house. They're trying to get rid of this married couple. At the same time, they need to get back to their house because they can't be there because the Parks are coming home. There's a lot going on. The Parks get back and they eventually do escape the house after the Parks have fallen asleep. And they go back to their house and it's flooded and there's everything's gone. So they got to stay in a kind of this, I don't know, this like shelter for a night.
Yeah, it was like a gym.
Yeah. This is kind of where we start and a little bit before this, even this is where we kind of start to see, how the dad, especially, starts to notice that the Park family does not think very much of the Kim family. And he doesn't like that. You know, he definitely thinks they look down on them and he wants to feel like his family is welcomed. And there's definitely an internal struggle there for sure.
Oh, for sure. And then this is where we get the scene, you know, when they're laying on the gym floor, this is where we get the scene of Mr. Kim saying like something to the effect of the best plan is having no plan, because then things always go according to plan. Essentially, kind of, it's a moving scene. It's interesting insight into his character, because really, I think this is kind of the secret thing about Parasite, you know, that people don't often pick up on. They view it as just a simple like class struggle story. And I don't think it's that simple. I think it's about individuals and whether or not they're able to make a plan to put their lives together, to put things in order, you know? And we see that Mr. Kim is not interested in making a plan for his life. He's just kind of drifting by. And it's only because of the smart thinking of his son that he's able to get employed at all. It was a team effort. So
yeah,
I think that's a really crucial scene for kind of decoding this, the themes of the movie.
Right. That's one of the best scenes of the movie for sure. Where do we go? So from here, we're approaching the ending at this point. It seems like they've gotten away with everything. They've locked, the wife or the old maid dies. She's killed in the struggle. And they've locked the husband in the basement once again. And essentially now it's the rich kid. Is it the son's birthday? I think, yeah, it's the son's birthday.
It's the son's birthday, yeah. The
Park family. And they're all supposed to be there. And I think, Sam, I think this scene that comes up is why everyone loves this movie so much. And the ending, really. essentially, gosh, like this scene is really great too. And scenes that follow it are awesome. Everything goes not according to plan. Is essentially what happens after we have that great scene. Him saying, "Don't have plans." Nothing goes accordingly. Yeah. The guy breaks out from the basement, severely injures the Kim son. You know, he's bleeding via the head. We're kind of thinking he's dead.
Yeah.
He comes up, kind of looking like a zombie type thing. You know, he's kind of a horror figure almost because he's all bloodied and everything.
Yeah.
The Park son faints, and he ultimately, the guy that was living in the basement and broke free, kills the daughter of the Kims, the poor mm-hmm. daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And there's yeah. this aftermath of the father choosing, which is a really good moment, actually. The Kim father chooses his daughter to be with her in her last moments over taking the rich kid to the hospital after fainting. And it's a really good moment and a great part of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Crucial. Definitely crucial. Yeah. I mean, it's like you said, it doesn't go according to plan. If you understand, you know, the difference between first degree and second degree in a legal sense, you know, first degree is premeditated. You had time to make a plan. Second degree is like, in the moment, spur of the moment, what do I do? There's a witness, right. I kill him, you know. This is all second degree stuff because one thing leads to another. I mean, the old maid dies. So her husband gets angry, runs upstairs, kills poor kid. And then one thing leads to another. And then here we are. So, I mean, yeah, all of a sudden this movie, again, turns our expectations. We're expecting kind of a more drawn out conclusion to this entire, this complex character structure. You know, we have a lot of characters that we're paying attention to.
Right.
And then boom. And again, in about 5 minutes, we kind of have some kind of resolution, which plays again to your point. I mean, this movie is so ridiculously efficient.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so much happens there. And the poor dad kills the rich dad, which is just this huge shock. Mm-hmm. And then he's on the run, of course. And we don't know where he went. He fleed of somewhere. And it's a great scene because it's utter chaos. Which is obviously what it was intended to be. So,
right.
It's perfect in that sense. And from here, you know, we're thinking who's left, and the daughter's dead. The son we're thinking is dead. The father has fled. But we wake up with the son in the hospital, and we kind of find out he's all right. Although probably been in a coma for a little while, but he's okay. And this is the really sad part where we do meet, or we do finally realize for sure that the daughter is dead. The mom takes the son to her grave kind of, mm-hmm. and I don't know if this is a thing in Korea, but kind of a really cool grave area. Not like a graveyard, but more of a wall type.
Yeah.
Thing
with it. Yeah.
Super cool scene right there too.
Yeah. Very interesting stuff. Yeah. But yeah, this is it. I mean, the one thing, like I said, you know, we find resolution in that bloody chaotic scene somehow. And the only loose end that isn't tied up is, where is Mr. Kim?
Yeah.
Where did he escape to? And then we kind of have this long drawn out concluding, I would almost call it like kind of like a coda, like it kind of exists outside of the rest of the narrative, you know, it's just kind of, it switches the tone again. So it feels like a third movie, you know, maybe if you were to divide this movie up, it'd be like, I would consider it, you know, comedy section, action thriller section, and then this like kind of complacent short film at the end.
Yeah. That's a good point.
To kind of tie that last end up.
Yeah. I mean, so the son goes on this kind of long narration, writing a letter to his father, who has disappeared. And it, like you said, it's a really great, it's really well put together. It makes complete sense. And it's pretty touching. And he's kind of sitting up on this perch, looking down at the house he worked at, that his family worked at. And mm-hmm. this light that we've been seeing flickering for the longest time, or it's always been able to flicker. And we learned earlier in the movie that it can be controlled from the basement by turning it on and off. And the dad is sending Morse code to his son, writing a letter to him. And it's this super great moment. Maybe a little forced or something, but yeah, great, great moment.
Yeah. Yeah. My thing with this ending is, on its own, I think it's great. Within the context of the film, that tone change, that another tone change, is just so jarring. You know, it's we slow way down all of a sudden, and it just thematically, it feels unconnected to the rest of the film. And really, if I were to point out a weakness in this movie, I would point to the end. Like, all of a sudden, the end just kind of drags for me. But again, that just contributes to the uniqueness of it as a film. Again, the tone is really hard to pin down. The other thing that I kind of wondered about is, why can't Mr. Kim just escape the house?
I think it comes down to authorities are looking for him. And he doesn't want to get found and arrested. I would assume that's it.
And that's the only place he can really hide, I suppose. Yeah. But
no, nobody else knows about it. The basement, that is.
Right, right.
It's interesting that the ending kind of drags for you, because I remember watching this the first time, and the ending kind of brought it all together for me. So it's interesting that we play so differently on that field, at least. So
yeah, I think the difference is that it's only tying up that one end. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Sure. Versus the rest of the movie, which is entertaining like seven different plot points at once. You know what I mean?
Right.
I think that's what it comes down to.
Sure.
But that being said, I mean, then really, with kind of tying up this loose end, then we have the kind of ambiguous piece of this movie.
We don't know where it goes.
We really don't know where it goes. We kind of have this final shot of the son predicting that they will one day have enough money to buy the house and reunite with the father. And we see a visual shot of that, but we're not sure if that's real or if that's just a fantasy.
Yeah. And it's a really good parallel to what that scene earlier where his father says, don't have any plans. You know, he kind of took that and said, no, I'm going to have plans, and they will happen. So my interpretation would be, this is going to happen. Like, this did happen. That'd be my thought on it, at least, is that, you know, his father said, don't make plans. He said, I'm going to make plans, and it's going to happen. And here's what it'll look like when it will happen. So, I mean, it could be taken multiple ways. That's what's really great about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And this brings up another interesting question, and I've heard this question entertained before. If you were to point out a villain in this movie, an antagonist, who would you say it is?
I would say there's kind of small villains through different plot points. You know, the park father is a villain sometimes by kind of saying that, or looking down, like I said earlier, looking down on them. The guy in the basement is a villain sometimes, and then the whole Kim family can kind of be the villain at point. So there's not really a specific villain.
Yeah, I really think it's primarily Mr. Kim, the poor family dad. I think he really,
sure,
his entire philosophy about no plans does not serve them well.
No.
It's only through his son making smart, calculated decisions that they're able to survive at all. It's just an interesting question to bring up. And really, I don't think we can ever do all of these characters justice. I mean, all the characters are so well developed. so quickly. And the symbolism throughout, I mean, we didn't really even get into that, but it's everywhere if you look. So
yeah, it's a really deep film. So, I mean, you said Iceberg earlier, but that's 100% true. I mean, there's a lot beneath the water of this movie that you could dissect and analyze and really get into for sure.
Definitely.
That's really all I have thoughts for the movie, Sam, but I do want to talk about its position on Letterboxd and its win at the Oscars as well, just for a little bit. Let's start with the Letterboxd. So we said it earlier, it's sitting at number one and not likely to change. And I'm curious, what are your thoughts on that? Like, this is a very good movie. We've just raved about it and really only kind of came up with a few complaints, but number one.
Yeah. I just don't know what nerve it really struck with. Well, not a nerve, you know, a chord, you know, there's something about it that people really attach to. And I think it's a great film. I don't think it's anything special in terms of, if you look at great films only, I don't think it's anything special within its own category, you know? So essentially what the people of Letterboxd have said is that, no, this is the greatest movie ever made, or at least the greatest movie that everyone has seen. So I don't know what to make of it. I don't know what about it specifically, what people attach to, but yeah, I mean, it's just kind of random, you know, no plan.
It does feel a little random. Yeah. I think people really like this movie because of that ending.
Sure.
So I think people like it because of the ending. I think it's number one because I think it's number one because everyone else is giving it 5 stars. So why don't I, type thing.
Yeah. Yeah. People probably watched it and they, you know, there's this expectation bias, right? You know, they get all this movie gets all this hype, right? You know, everyone's saying it's just a masterpiece, it's just incredible, and then you go in and watch it and it is great, you know, you watch it, it's great, but then that blinds you to some of the flaws and you're just like, okay, knee-jerk reaction, 5 stars.
Right, yeah,
and we've seen that with movies before, but nothing like the hype that Parasite gets, you know, nothing.
For sure. Yeah, it's one in its own, for sure. I mean, there's nothing that's even close to it in terms of how much hype it got right away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, it's crazy.
That's interesting. Now, before we get into our star ratings, I want to ask you about its campaign at the Oscars. Like, what do you think about it winning Best Picture?
That was a crazy moment.
Yeah,
that was really crazy. Man, I think it was deserved. I really do. I thought it was great for the Academy to recognize something that's really out of the box. And to really the first, you know, foreign language film to win Best Picture, really expose mainstream American audiences to something foreign. You know, Bong Joon-ho said something like, that little 1-inch wall of subtitle is all that's keeping people from, you know, new worlds of cinema. And really, I think Parasite is a nice introduction to Korean cinema and just international cinema generally, because again, like I said before, South Korea is very similar to America. Just in terms of cultural attitudes.
Right.
So it's something people can cling on to. So I think it's great that it won Best Picture. It was shocking. It was awesome. Yeah.
What would you have, given the award to? Would you have given it if you had a vote?
Well, I mean, of the nominees.
Yeah.
Cause I would have nominated Uncut Gems.
Of the nominees.
Let me look at the 2019 nominees. Because I forget what they were No, this is giving me the 2018 people. God. Okay. I know what you would have given it to.
You're right, Irishman. You got me.
Yeah, exactly, Irishman. I would probably give it to the Irishman, honestly.
Really?
But that's just me. Or Hollywood. I mean, Hollywood was phenomenal as well.
Yeah, sure.
I know exactly what you're giving it to, but
yeah, I mean, this is pretty obvious. This is going to Little Women. I mean, go on. But no, seriously, I love Parasite, man. And last year, or 2 years ago now. Wait, I'm so lost. Yeah, 2 years ago, I guess. 2019 was just such a great year for movies. Like, it's absurd that Parasite on my 2020 Best Picture nominees ranked list, it literally sits at number 5, which just blows my mind because that movie's great. But it's number 5. So yeah, I'd go Little Women, Hollywood, Marriage Story, Ford V, and then Parasite. But that's just my personal preference. Love Parasite though. It seemed, you know, it obviously wasn't my first choice, but I'm glad that it won, for the sole reason that it breaks that stigma, like that foreign language films can't win Best Picture.
Yeah. Yeah.
My vote in the previous year before this one would have gone to Roma, another foreign language, and that didn't win, and Green Book won. So, which I will say I think is a good movie, but I recognize there's flaws. I would have given it to Roma, and that didn't happen. So I'm glad that Parasite won for that fact.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And a great
moment. I'm with you there. Great moment
to get Bong up there one more time with his translator was awesome.
We love his translator, don't we?
Yeah.
My God.
But so Sam, what would you give Parasite in terms of star rating?
I give Parasite a 4 out of 5. I think it's a high 4.
Good.
Bordering on a 4.5, but I think it's a high 4. That ending kind of drags down. It's hard to pin down which characters you're supposed to be rooting for. It's kind of a disorienting film early on.
Yeah.
And then as you kind of, it definitely requires a second watch.
How many times have you seen it?
I've seen it twice.
Okay. I'm the same.
How many times did you see it?
I've seen it twice too. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I brought my dad the second time, which, was incredible because, you know, my dad's not really a Korean cinema connoisseur, nor am I.
Yeah, right.
But I brought him along and he thought it was fantastic too. And it's just so cool, you know?
For sure.
But yeah. Yeah. So that's where I'm at. Where are you at?
I'm slightly above you. I would say, like, out of 100, I'd be like 3 above you.
Sure.
I'm going to go 4.5. Really low 4.5 though. It's almost at a 4. I've changed my rating for Parasite to 4 to 4.5 to back to 4 to 4.5, probably 5 times. So it's so close to both of those. I'll go 4.5 right now just because I'm excited about talking about it. So 4.5.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really good movie though.
Yeah.
This is my introduction to Bong Joon-ho too. So I've seen a few more of his movies. None as good as Parasite. So I guess.
No, definitely not. Definitely not.
I guess that has something, but Sam, should we get into recommendations?
Let's hit some recommendations. Yeah.
All righty. Well, I mean, if you want to go for it.
I mean, I'm ready to go.
Go for it.
The other night I watched a friend of mine just kind of randomly said, "You want to watch this movie? This looks good." So we watched it. It's called 50-50 with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Seth Rogen. This movie, you want to talk about dark comedies? This is about as dark as it gets. Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays a young man who's stricken with a rare and aggressive type of cancer. And he does some Googling and finds out that his chances of survival are about 50-50. And it's kind of a darkly heartwarming tale of, you know, him and his best friend, Seth Rogen. And Seth Rogen essentially plays Seth Rogen
right.
in this movie.
Yeah, he's the same.
You know, more or less, just like this kind of awful person, just womanizing, kind of exploiting his friend's cancer diagnosis to elicit sympathy from women. And it's just kind of this like very, very dark comedy. So if you're into that kind of thing, there are some moments that are genuinely heartwarming. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt gives just such a committed performance that there are certain times where you're like, oh my God, that is incredible acting. Like just incredible. But yeah, it was worth checking out. Check out 50-50.
Yeah, Sam, that's been on my watch list for so long, and I've always wanted to give it a shot. So I'm good that I got your endorsement, and I'll definitely be giving that a watch.
Totally.
So my recommend for the week, as we do this series, I wanted each recommend to be tangentially related to the winner. So this week, I'm going to go with another Bong Joon-ho movie. So if you're a fan of Parasite, if you're a fan of Bong Joon-ho, then check out Memories of Murder. It's one of his earlier films, essentially about a murder mystery of someone and some detectives that are trying to solve it. Again, it's really tight, really well made. Not as good as Parasite, but still very good. It also has Song Kang-ho, the main guy, and Mr. Kim in Parasite. So,
Mr. Kim.
If you just love that dude, go for it.
We do.
But yeah, Memories of Murder. It's really solid, really quite good. And more ambiguity if you like ambiguous stuff. So,
dude, I need to check that out then. I really do. I need to watch more Bong.
For sure. So I've only seen Parasite, Snowpiercer, which I just hate Snowpiercer, man. I can't stand that movie.
That is a disappointing movie, yeah, certainly.
1.5 is way too high. Oh my gosh. Okja, which is slightly better than Snowpiercer, but not great. And Memories of Murder. So he's 2 for 4 in my eyes, which,
okay,
you know, if you can bat 500, that's not bad.
it's a good standard. It's a good standard to have.
Yeah. But yeah, there we go. There's Parasite. Sam, Green Book right now. Let's start. All right. What are your thoughts?
We'll get into it. Hopefully not anytime too soon, right. But we'll get into it sometime in the next year. Yeah.
Or we'll skip that one.
Or we might just skip it. Who cares? but anyway, yeah, with that,
where can I find you on Letterboxd, Sam?
You can find me at letterboxd.com/SJJerberger. And where can I find you, Will Spalding?
You find me on Letterboxd at Will Spalding, and you can find us on our website at thosefilmnerds.weebly.com and thosefilmnerds.anchor.fm/thosefilmnerds. Oh my gosh, couldn't speak there. Or you find us on any podcast platforms at Those Film Nerds, or in Those Film Nerds on Instagram, or thosefilmnerds@gmail.com. If you have any movie-related thoughts, send them in. But Sam, with that being said,
keep watching movies, everyone. Have a great week.
Thank you.